This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show number 159. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can call us on
02088167691.
You can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
My name's David Hinchliffe, and this week I'm joined by Mark Garraway and Berners. So it's the cricket season here in England, and therefore it's raining.
And it certainly is at Millfield, I can tell you.
It's hammering down here as well.
Yeah, so that's our weather report from across the country. I've been looking at the performance of Yusuf Pathan in the IPL this week. He's had a pretty torrid time in this IPL. He's barely got a run, and this is sort of on the back of having a lot of success in international cricket. So, but he's seen as, you know, your impact guy, isn't he? The guy who comes out and smashes boundaries and hits it all over the place. So he tends to be given a little bit more leeway. Players like that tend to be given a little bit more leeway, don't they, than players who are seen as sort of your classical batsman. They're given freedom, and they say, well, if you fail, then that's, you know, that's bad luck. But that makes it difficult to measure the success of a player who does something like that. So I guess what I wanted to talk about this week a little bit was, how do you measure the success of impact style players, pinch hitters and match winners, as they're called, the guys who come out and smash it at the end of limited over games?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, that. And you know, every team and every captain around the world would probably would love to know a bit of a formula or how to judge that, because we've all got them, haven't we? We've all got somebody within our teams who I've just coached one, actually, a lad that plays in our second team at school, who can smash it an absolute country mile. But you know, how many times do you let him not score runs for that one game where he comes in? You know, how much leeway should he get? And it's a really good debate. In the IPL, it's a little bit easier, to be honest, because certainly companies that I've been working with have got some statistics for working out player effectiveness. It's going to be interesting. We talk about stats a lot on this show, but one of the things that will happen over time will people's ability to win matches will be assessed so much better. And without giving too many trade secrets away, to be honest, there's a couple of companies out there that are doing that sort of thing, and a number of teams around the world that are actually using that data to help with their selections. That stuff is going on. And as I say, Yusuf Pathan, up until this year, has been very good in the IPL, and is actually featured in the top 10 of the players, which include people like Chris Gayle, as you won't be surprised to know, but also bowlers like Malinga, who have positively impacted on wins in a big way for their franchise. So it is happening. That sort of stuff is happening, but it's not common knowledge, and it will stay that way, I should imagine, for a fair amount of time.
He's actually having a bit of a torrid time of it at the moment, isn't he, in this current series? And I've read a couple of reports that are linking that to his demise from the Indian national team. So saying, you know, before, obviously, when you go in as a player in that kind of groove, it's a lot of it's orientated towards confidence and being able to go in and you know, apply his core skills with the game situation quite nicely. But if that balance isn't quite there and he's not quite at the races mentally for what the game scenario requires, it kind of all ends up in tears.
So bringing it back to your club level, your club side with the blacksmith who comes out with the bat slung over his shoulder at number 6 or 7. Do you say, well, if he comes off 1 in 6, then, you know, that's the job done? Is there any kind of guideline you can do, or do you have to just look at the player's confidence level and say, well, if he's still feeling good and he's not worried about it, then carry on? But if he's...
You can do that. And Bob Woolmer used to talk about pinch hitters in One Day International. I'm talking, you know, 10 years ago now. Mm. And he worked out that a pinch hitter would come off once every 7 innings. Okay, in One Day International cricket. So he had lots of theories, Bob, based upon some pretty sound stats. And one of his was that you have two pinch hitters in your squad so you can alternate them, because, you know, sides get used to somebody pinch hitting and then adopt different tactics. But if you can slot them in every now and again, then would that work? Now, he never got the backing or never managed to get that actually into place. But what an interesting concept that is. Mm. But the premise behind it is, back these people. you know, back these match winners, because ultimately we can play attritional cricket for so much of a time and get our results, but we need to have match winners in there. And the idea of a team, and the whole thing about a team, is to try and blend all of these different bits and bobs. So, you know, the reason why KP can play in matches, or, you know, Owen Morgan for a bit can play in matches as like he did for England, was because people like Cookie and Jonathan Trott have set that foundation, you know, for those guys to then go and win the game. So I think it's all about blend. That's the exciting bit about cricket. And my advice to the second team management at school has been to incorporate this player, and he will fail more often than not, but he will win you a game of cricket that you wouldn't win otherwise, and ultimately we play to win.
Goes back to the older Moneyball theory, doesn't it, where you've got to have the right mix of players to create success, and having a guy like that, you need, like you say, the Bob Warmer thing was classic. We need a couple of these guys. They do work.
Mm. Yeah,
but you have to allow for them to fail as well, because you know that there's going to be plenty of times when they don't.
Well, yeah, it's
exactly. If you're asking them to play, you know, if you're saying to them, right, you've got to come off once every two games, then they're going to change their style and try and bat like somebody else. And there's probably somebody else that bats naturally like that that's going to do the job better. So, you know, to me, I love having people in there that can potentially change the course of a game, because the opposition know it as well. Because when they walk to a wicket, even if they are carrying their bat over their shoulder, like the guy that you've described playing club cricket, there's a change in the feel of the game. All right, and it puts the opposition on the back foot. And you know, the whole thing about team is to incorporate different characters, different playing styles, and blend that into a unit. And I think sometimes we can get a little bit too carried away with just churning things out. Let's keep the excitement in there. You know, that's what cricket's about.
Okay, let's wrap up the introduction then with our now infamous yes-no round. Each of us will get the chance to answer yes or no to three questions without having to think about it too much or explain our answers. So controversy reigns in this section. Berners, you've got the questions. Let's go for it.
Have indeed. Okay, guys. Fielding should take more than a third of practice sessions.
Yes.
Yes.
The word academy is overused.
Yes.
Massively yes.
Health and safety is restricting young cricketers' development.
No.
No.
Time now for the weekly interview on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. And this week I'm joined by Dr. Carl Stevenson, who is a sports psychologist who's worked with the ECB. Welcome to the show, Carl.
Hi, how are you, David?
I'm very good, thank you. Now, tell us a little bit about yourself and what kind of things you're working on at the moment.
Sure. As you've mentioned, I come from a sports psychology background. And over the last couple of years, I've just been researching the ins and outs of anticipation and decision-making skill in cricket batting. I've been lucky enough to work with some top-flight county teams, as well as recently teaming up with the ECB for my latest bit of research. And, you know, the research is quite fruitful. There's a lot there to be looked at. You know, and aside from research, I lecture at the University of Brighton, and I also focus a little bit on consultancy as well.
So that research about anticipation and decision making, that's all related to what the batsman is doing as the bowler is running into bowl and getting into position to bowl, about whether deciding whether to play forward or back, what shot to play, etc., etc. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And that, you know, that's the skill that I'm, you know, trying to focus on. There has been research to identify that, you know, skilled batsmen are able to use more successful cues to pick up spin directions and delivery lengths. And they use different visual search strategies to novice cricketers. I mean, they've got specific points where they look and the timings of where they look to get as much information as possible compared to novices who simply just scan the body sort of at will and hope to get out the information that they see there and then. So there is a distinct difference between the two different skill sets. And I think it's, you know, it's the difference between why you develop such a high level skilled player versus someone who can be technically sound but not able to make the same level of decisions as someone in the top flight.
And from what you've seen so far, is your theory that this kind of thing is innate, or is it something that is trainable?
I think, you know, it's definitely trainable. For me, I think that there is always a capacity for something to be trained. You know, it's a very interesting and often, you know, sort of misinterpreted question when people generally talk about talent. They assume that it's something that is genetic, which automatically allows a person with more talent to be more successful or more skillful than a person who possesses less talent. And I think, you know, that there are a few problems with this. You know, the main assumption is, you know, is talent something that is tangible? You know, how do you measure raw talent? How do you know what raw talent looks like? And I think, you know, most coaches will say, oh, no, I can just tell that he's talented, or you can see it in their performances. But at the end of the day, you've got a question. How do you know that their performance, even if, you know, you're dealing with a youngster, is not a result of their practice or some of the previous experiences that they've had in similar sports? Because, you know, there has been shown to be a crossover between playing a wide range of sports during your youth and actually the development of expertise in other domains as you get older.
That's interesting, because it flies in the face of a more sort of traditional idea that people have, in that there's some people with natural talent, they don't really need to practice. If you think of here in England, you know, the traditional kind of, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, you think of somebody like David Gower, who seemed like he didn't have to practice, and or Ian Botham, who just had that free spirit and did just seem like it all came naturally and easily to him, certainly on the surface. But these days, cricket training isn't really like that anymore, even certainly at the professional level, and even at the amateur level, you know, people focus a lot more on using practice to improve. So how has that mentality changed, as you see it, over the last few years? How has it switched from one to the other like that?
Sure. I mean, I think coaches these days are asking themselves different questions. You know, there's two questions that I essentially ask myself when it comes to assessing sports performance. And in terms of cricket, I would say, you know, what does a successful cricketer look like? Okay, is there a mould for a successful cricketer? Is there an ideal height for a cricketer? Are there ideal physiological characteristics of a cricketer? And then secondly, you know, I'd look at what a successful cricketer does. Okay, and when you start to look at the second question, you begin to pin down a lot more skill set answers and lots of talents and traits that people don't have in relation to that. But when you assess their skills, you know, you can have someone that's 6'2" performing the same skill as someone who's 5'8". So for me, there is no mould of a cricketer. And I think, you know, that shift an understanding has sort of changed the direction of cricket training immensely over the last few years. You know, there's been a few stepping stones in the development of cricket training. You know, the idea of physical fitness, you know, back in the Gower days or the Botham days was, you know, something of the, you know, that just did not exist, and there was no importance attached to it. And then, you know, people started to look into the nutrition and its importance. And I think now, you know, the trend has turned to specificity of practice, and in my opinion, that has increased professionalism of the game tenfold. You only have to look as far as fielding in the modern game, and have a look how far that's come in the last 5 years to see the trend. These days, you know, if you mess up a sliding boundary stop, you're considered a weak link in the team. However, 10 years ago, if you performed, you know, some of the acrobatics that, you know, some of the likes of AB de Villiers and whatnot doing these days, you know, you get a huge just pat on the back for even trying that. So I think it's very important to see that shift and that dynamic of practice change.
So you used the word specificity there, and so I'm thinking now of a cricketer who goes to practice once or maybe twice a week. He doesn't play professionally, he's an amateur, or maybe he's in some kind of an academy. He wants to get the most of practice. He wants to use the power of that specific practice. So what practical things can he do when he goes to net practice?
So I think, you know, in my opinion, the best thing that any cricketer can do is just be objective about your practice. know exactly what you want to get out of your practice, and also don't be afraid to be creative when you train. Too many times in club or academy level cricket, you see people just being fed hundreds and hundreds of balls out of a bowling machine with no target to that training. And when you train like that, it's very, you know, very generic practice. You aren't putting any pressure or any strain on the existing skill set that you possess. So the question is, I mean, how do you expect to put in a better performance over the weekend if you're not straining the skill that you already have? So when it comes to specificity, you know, I would challenge any club cricketer to train like a professional. You know, I know the intensity might not be the same, but if you go about emulating a professional, you engage in a different type of practice. We call it deliberate practice, and it's targeted towards improving a specific skill set. So let's just say, for instance, you know, when we were all younger, we used to try and emulate our heroes. When I was younger, I used to try and emulate more South African cricketers. That's, you know, that was where I lived, and that's what I tried to emulate. And I think people let go of that too early. They should try and keep hold of that. So let's just say, if I was a batsman, and I was timing the ball absolutely perfectly at the weekend, but I wasn't finding any gaps, and I wasn't scoring as many runs as I should have done, my skill set might be there, but the mental side of the game needs to change. I need to try something different. And, you know, the best way that you can do that is sort of by manipulating the situation. Mm. So let's just say, for instance, you could try and hit, you know, 20 balls through a channeled gap, make it a challenge, try and measure it, and try and better it the next set of balls you do. Not only does it improve your technical skills, but as I said before, it engages a far more demanding mental process. And engaging in that mental process, you know, would lead to people scoring hundreds, not your quick 30 or a flash in the pan here and there.
So is this something you can do individually, as a batsman or a bowler? Is this something you can do just by switching your mentality of the way that you're training? Or do you need the structure of training to change as well?
You know, I think some people are different. You know, a lot you get different people in different practice environments. So you obviously get your individualists who enjoy working a lot on their own. But, you know, I would stress it as a group process, as a whole team process. I know at club level, some people, you know, might question, well, I'm only here to have fun. I'm only here to enjoy myself. But at the end of the day, you've got to question whether you'd enjoy yourself if you're going out and performing more, or whether you'd just be performing on the same level. It's very nice to see improvement. So I would try and target it as a whole, but don't be afraid to, you know, go off on your own and work as hard as you want on your own. And it's a process that you can engage in as much as you want or as little as you want. And I think that's the important thing. You know, someone like Kevin Peterson has just been cited for spending hours and hours of individual practice in the nets. And eventually, you know, you might have your rough patches, but you can see that practice pays off. And he never doubts himself because he knows that he's put the time and effort in.
Well, Carl, it's a fascinating area and one we could probably talk about for hours, but we've run out of time on the show for the interview this week. So thank you very much for coming on the show and giving us a really interesting overview into talent development.
Not a problem. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Time now for the question section on the show. We answer your burning cricket coaching questions, and the best question of the week gets to win a prize, which is an online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So we've got two more questions this week from cricketers and coaches. Well, a cricketer and a coach. So, Bernard, you've got those. What are the questions this week?
Okay, we've got a question from Sam, who's an aspiring leg spinner by the sound of things, so very exciting there. He's saying that he's just learning the art. Obviously, it is pretty difficult, and at the moment, he's just bowling a series of hard spun traditional leg spinners, some top spinners, and he throws a couple of sliders in. He's struggling with his googly. However, he just wants to get noticed by coaches in the higher grades, and is wondering what he can do as a leg spinner to try and do that.
Well, I'd say the obvious thing first: get it out of the way. Take lots of wickets. I mean, nothing speaks more. There's no tactical tip or thing that you can do any better than have the stats to back up what you're saying. Take the personal responsibility for doing that, and selectors will be naturally attracted to you if they're looking at the stats and seeing someone at the top of the bowling averages every week. But also, the other probably main thing that I would say is don't be afraid to go and ask. Don't be afraid to find out what you need to do. If you can speak to a coach who is, whatever your ambition, if you can speak to a coach who is coaching at representative level that you want to play at, or at a higher grade that you want to play at, then there's no harm in sidling up to them at the bar one evening, offering to buy them a drink and saying, what do I need to do to make it to the next level? And they might say something that you hadn't thought of. They might say, well, yeah, we like your bowling, but to be honest with you, you know, you really need to get your fielding up to scratch. Or, you know, when we pick spinners, we always pick a spinner who can bat a bit. So then you can go away and work on those things, and then go back then to later on to that guy when you worked on those things and say, look, I've done what's required. What else do you need me to do? Those would be the two main things that I would look at first. What about you, Gareth?
Well, I'm liking, where does this lad live? Because I'd love to have him at Millfield. If he can bowl hard-spun leggies, top spinners and sliders, then, you know, fantastic. 15 years old, that's magnificent. So well done on that to start off with. The second point is leg spinners traditionally, if you follow a graph of when leg spinners mature, they mature later than any other role within a game of cricket. So as a 15-year-old, you've got a great head start, but be patient because, you know, by the time you're 25, 26, that's really the start of you reaching your really golden years as such. But if you can master your art by the age of 29, 30, then you've still got another 6 or 7 years to absolutely pick up on your wickets. And the last thing is, be a wicket-taking bowler. How do you get noticed? David said it. It's about stats. But to me, as a leg spinner, you're different. You've got a gift, which is different from every other type of bowler that bowls in a game of cricket. And your role as a leg spinner isn't to keep the runs down. Your role is to get wickets because you are different. So even if you're going at five and over, keep trying to take wickets every single ball. And it was one of the best bits of advice that Terry Jenner, who was Shane Warne's coach, ever gave to me, is that leg spinners are wicket-takers. They're not economical bowlers, they're wicket takers, and captains and coaches and players need to start understanding that. You know, in there you've got enough, but congratulations on being able to bowl hard spun leggies, top spinners and sliders at the age of 15.
Next question's from Brendan, who asks a question here regarding junior cricketers or players of any level, which the most important part of the game is: technique, tactical awareness or strength and conditioning.
It's an interesting one, Brendan, because the most important one on there, I don't think, is in the question. They're all important, obviously. But to me, your mental approach and attitude is the most important thing, because if you look at the people that master their technique over the years, that's fueled by their approach to practice. That's fueled by their enthusiasm to tough it out when somebody's throwing the ball hard at them or bowling the ball hard at them. It's, you know, it's going running in the mornings. You know, that's a strength and conditioning thing, but also to get through that door, you've got to be mentally tough to be able to do it. So the difference to me between the good and the great are the guys who are mentally tough. So that would be the most important one for me. On your list, I think that the others are all equally as valued, the technique, tactical awareness and strength and conditioning. But for me, if you give me a cricketer, it's got has got a good mental capacity, who really wants to go beyond the norms and push himself, then all of those things that you've listed down there will ultimately be improved.
It's a bit of a an academic exercise, a paper exercise, really, because no one's going to, not anymore anyway. I mean, maybe a few years ago, there would have been coaches who say technique is everything and you don't need to worry about anything else. But even those coaches would say that you need to have game sense. So even that is academic, I think. But you're going to give equal attention to them as much as you can. The way I looked at it was that would you want someone who's got a great technique but no sense and no fitness? Would you want someone who has knows exactly what's going on but can't get a run or a wicket because their technique's horrible and they're unfit? Or would you want someone who can run all day but they don't know what they're doing? Probably I would go for the guy with the technique but just didn't have a clue what was going on and feasted on pies every dinner time. What do you think, Berners? If you had to pick one.
Well, I think Gara's made a good point. You know, you don't get anywhere without having a bit of self-motivation and drive, but then you kind of need other components to feed off of that, don't you? So I think as a player, you can develop having certain elements of those to start with, which give you the encouragement and the fun factor and the feel-good factor to actually enjoy what you're doing. So maybe developing a technique is least important, but actually probably the most important, because if you can't actually do what you're trying to do, that's a very frustrating thing, right?
Yeah, and in a way, it's all integrated anyway, isn't it? So it's not easy to pick one of those out. So as you seem to be saying there, Berners, it's all one in the same anyway.
Yeah.
In the end,
being tactically aware is not essential, is it? When you're playing to start with, because they're things that you pick up around other people, and it's one of the easier facets of the game, I would say, to kind of get an understanding for as you kind of move through. Just being able to actually do what you want to do is the hardest part.
Yeah, I mean, the tactical awareness thing, is as long as you've got three or four players on your side that are really tactically aware, then in the large part, you're all right, you're covered. You know, ideally, we'd want all 11, as Vaughney would say, you know, I want 11 captains on the pitch. But I think he's meaning more of the leadership skills rather than the actual ability to set a field or to be able to work somebody out over 18 balls as a leader, really. The other thing I was going to say is Steve Ball, who was England's sports psychologist for 20 years, I think, is one of the most eminent sports psychologists in the world, wrote a great article about having threshold and differentiators. And he considered technique to be a threshold thing. By you need to get up to a very bare minimum level of technique to be able to survive at the top level. After that, it's all down to your differentiators, and your differentiators are things like your mental capacity, it's your resilience, it's your bounce back ability, it's your coachability, it's all of those things that sit deep within an individual rather than on the external like a technique. So Paul Collingwood is somebody to me who is a great example of somebody who probably just scraped over the technical bar to be able to play at international cricket and do bloody well at international cricket. But he had so many other things that meant, you know, his capacity to stand up to fast bowlers, to get through a situation, to captain a side in tough situations and win World Cups. All of those things are all about what's within the cricketer. And that's why I say that's the most important thing, because you can give me that person. You give me 10 Paul Collingwoods and I'll win you a World Cup.
Yeah, I like that. That's really good. Really good, that. I'm happy with that, Garris. I like that a lot. Because when you think about it, that's so true. You know, when you watch live sport, you often think, God, he looks a bit almost ugly, or it doesn't...
Broke
it,
yeah.
But then you think, God, the determination and the grit inside that guy. You know, what epitomises that for me with Collingwood is his fielding. When you watch him, his concentration, his catching, they put him in the key areas, just, you know, cover point, places like that. And you think, well, hang on a minute, this guy, he's switched on here, he's right in the zone. And you see it with, I think cricket kind of amplifies it more so than other sports in terms of that, like you say, having just that maybe that scratchy looking kind of technique, but it does the job, you know, like this guy, Steve Smith for Australia. You watch him and you think, how the hell is he doing all of this? He plays in the IPL, he plays for Australia, the amount of times that he's successful and his team do well, amazing, really. And you're thinking, well, he must be doing something right here. He must be, because he keeps on getting picks. You keep on seeing his name in the headlines.
Well, that's probably a whole topic for another time, because it's such a large and interesting area, especially the way that cricket's come from in the past, where the focus has all been making sure that technique is paramount, and everything else follows on from that. And it sounds like that's pretty much dead in the water nowadays. So definitely an interesting area to discuss on another podcast. So don't forget to subscribe to the show.
So here we are at the part of a show when one of the panel members gets up on the soapbox and rants and raves for a minute and gives some opinions that have been close to that person's chest and he wants to get it out. And this week it's David's turn.
Well, this week I wanted to talk about the differences of opinion between coaches. I deal with a lot of coaches working in Pitch Vision Academy, and there are many, many different opinions. Sometimes I think if you put 10 coaches in a room, you'll get 11 different opinions at the end of it. Things can be very, very different depending on where the coaches come from and what experiences they've got. But sometimes that we focus a little bit too much on the difference between different types of coaches, and we don't really think about the same things. So someone said to me once that if you think of ideas as rocks in a jar, then most people agree on the big rocks. The stuff that fills most of the jar up is things that everybody agrees on. It's only the little things, the pebbles and the sand, that we disagree on. And so we shouldn't focus too much on the things that we disagree on. We should try and look for the things that we all agree on and can come to a consensus and a best practice. Okay, so that's the end of the show for this week. But as always, before we go, we've got a couple of little things to sort out. The first of which is the competition. If you send in your question to the show, then you get a chance to win a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And we had Sam asking his question about how he got noticed at a higher grade, and Brendan asking about the importance of technique, tactics and strength conditioning. So, Gareth, what in your opinion was the most interesting question this week? I've got my own opinion, but it's over to you to decide.
Well, when I read them for the first time, I actually thought that Sam's question was going to come out on top. But because of the way that Brendan's question prompted discussion and got us into a pretty deep discussion about various different things, I'm going to give it to Brendan this week.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly support that. So congratulations, Brendan. Hopefully we answered your question in some way or another, but I think probably we made 5 or 6 more questions rather than answering the one that you sent in. But that's what good cricket discussion is all about. So feel free to send in any questions you've got related to that. Brendan, if you're listening, I'm sure you are, because you're a regular contributor, or anybody else got any follow-up questions or any burning cricket coaching questions, you can send those questions into us and you can win a prize, the online coaching from Pitch Vision Academy. So Berners, how would somebody get in touch with us if they wanted to do that?
They can give us a call on the phone, and that's 02088 167 691, or drop us a quick email, and the address for that is coach@pitchvision.com.
And also, if you're phoning us from anywhere else in the world, we've got international numbers on the website. You can get us through Twitter at PV Cricket Coach, and you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes, and if you head over to iTunes and type in Pitch Vision Academy, you'll find us there. Do a little search and click on subscribe. You can also leave a review if you're a fan of the show. But before we finally wrap up, we have our tail ender, our term of the week that is maybe a little bit lesser known.
Guy comes to the crease, starts majestically playing balls on the off stump through mid wicket, so a cry goes out of "This guy must like a 99, otherwise known as Mr. Whippy, whipping it from middle and off, straight through mid-wicket, and even sometimes behind square. So, yeah, he gets the Mr. 99, Mr. Whippy hat for the day.
I like it.
A good sledge. Anything to put somebody off their game without abusing their mother is good for me. So when you next play your game and you see someone playing through the leg side, there's your 99. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Berners.
Cheers, coach.